that I am stolen. The turn shall be traveled in Southeast Asia. There were jars that opened and jars that suddenly shut. And what we do is what God gives us to do. And so we keep moving, whether there or anywhere else in the world. We now continue, and I will generally follow the New English Bible here until I find I don't like it, and I'll go to another. In my empty existence, oh, Solomon the rich man. In my empty existence, I have seen it all. Most of you are not, I'd be glad of that. From a righteous man perishing in his righteousness to a wicked man growing old in his wickedness. That is, he has seen it all, the most illogical extreme. You wonder why the criminals get turned loose in society, and on the other page in the same newspaper, the little 2-year-old baby burned to death in the house. I just use a lot of illustrations from the time for the enthusiastic. But it's the same principle. Solomon saw that righteous people living in their righteousness perish before their time. The persecution, records were in the Old Testament, the records are in every generation. The wicked people seem to get by. Now most of them don't. But he saw everything. That is, he saw the extreme. One end of experience that ought not be to the other. And so he comes to this verse 16, and there are different ways of rendering this verse. Do not be over-righteous, do not be over-wise. Why make yourself a laughing stock? Now, I'm going to read that in more than one version, because sometimes these things are not as clear in any one translation. I don't think the RSV helps us that much, or the glance at it. And the Jewish translation is essentially the same as the English. And now I want to take a look at the other Bible I referred to here, verse 16. I like, and I don't like every bit of this translation, but I do like some. I think this is a real meaning of what Solomon is saying without having to add all kinds of commentary. Do not be over scrupulous or make a fetish of wisdom. Why make your life horrible? Have you seen people? I have. I've seen people who were so scrupulous over the least things that didn't count. Jesus addressed the question when he said there are people who will strain out a gnat in a suit and swallow a camel. They were very scrupulous. You know, over-righteous is another way of putting it, but not nearly as expressive as this particular verse in the Anchor Bible. Do not be over-scrupulous, where every little thing has to be examined and taken note of. And don't make a fetish of wisdom that you happen to want to give advice to everybody who comes along because you have an answer to everything until finally nobody wants to listen to you. A wise man knows when to hold his counsel. So why go to this extreme and make your life horrible? That's a little freer translation, but I do think that it conveys in the modern sense of the word what we are looking for in this version, where in ordinary speech we don't use such expressions as over-righteous or righteous over much. These are biblical expressions. What we want to know is how can I say it in modern English to convey an impact. And of course, don't be over-wicked and don't be a fool. Why should you die before your time? Now, there are a lot of people, you know, who do make mistakes in the world. Some like to make mistakes because they think it's possible. But Solomon is saying to those who don't intend to do right, that just remember, don't go to extremes, because anybody who goes to extremes is taking a terrible chance. And we do know this in society. sure in any version as I know. You read the King James and you will find it the same way. You have to hear come to some kind of rendering that conveys a meaning to you. Now, the general sense of the word seems to come clear in the commentary, and what it would seem to be is that the Hebrew is an expression that is not as clear to try to render it literally, but you have to give some special force and meaning to it. And if I spend a bit of time in verses not too consequential, what I want to say is that it does pay sometimes to look at other verses, and maybe in the Bible you normally use, to make special note of a good translation. You don't have space to write it in the margin, make note of which translation it is. The sense of it as given in the various translations is that it is good to consider both sides. That is, you want to grasp one side, but don't let another side of the argument escape. I think I've made it clearer than any translation just there, and you should take note of it. This is the new thought. Solomon is contrasting extremes, and in this case, this is the sense he's given. That when you grasp one side of an argument, also have a good sense to try to grasp the other side. That is to see the whole picture, to see both sides of the question. That is, I think, the best way to perceive the meaning of this verse 18. Now, a man who fears God will succeed both ways. Again, it's a very awkward expression. The Hebrew is best expressed, he who fears God will consider both sides. That is, will see and understand the argument that is being presented in one's favor or another's favor. And in the world things, you have a lot of this. In family relationships between children and parents, husbands and wives, employers and employees, and fellow employees, businesses with each other, you always have these things to weigh. And it pays to take a look at both sides. Solomon is using contrast all through here. Now to proceed with 19. Wisdom makes the wise man stronger than 10 rulers of a city. The world contains no man, verse 20, so righteous that he can do right always and never do wrong. Now, this is true also of women. Let me repeat it in another translation. It's very clear, but so that you know it refers to you. Yet there is no man so righteous that he always does what is best and never makes a mistake. That's the Anchor Bible, and I think it's very good. Now we proceed to another area. Do not pay attention to everything men say, or you may hear your servant disparage you. That's much better than the word curse. Because so much of our comments don't involve cursing or curses, but just disparaging remarks. Don't pay attention to everything men say. Now listen carefully. He didn't say pay attention to nothing that men say, but don't dwell on and pay attention to everything men say, or you may hear your servant disparage you. Of course, you want to reflect on the fact, for you know very well how many times you yourself have disparaged others. I think that's a beautiful translation, and the sense of to disparage is a very nice rendering. I think to use the word revile is too strong, or curse, doesn't convey the real sense of human experience. And if you're going to make a study of the Bible, it would certainly not hurt you to try to find these words that convey some clear meaning cannot be out of keeping, no far-fetched translation, but something that fits in true experience. And after all, this was Solomon's experience, and it fitted to yours. Now we proceed in verse 23. All this I have put to the test of wisdom. I said, I am resolved to be wise, but wisdom is beyond my grasp. Whatever has happened lies beyond our grasp, deep down, deeper than man can fathom. I think that's a beautiful expression in English. So that means that however wise Solomon was, wiser than any man in terms of the gifts that Christ gave him, yet he perceived that the ultimate depths of wisdom were beyond his grasp, deeper than man can fathom. That's the 24th verse, beautifully rendered in the New English Bible. Just looking at the RSV here, that's much better in the New English Bible here. I chose it because in going through this, I was impressed by the fact I liked more of the translation in this particular place. I don't go for a lot of the rest of it, but in occasion it is exceptional. And it's very good in this kind of area. And the British, you know, are very good at expressing themselves in the English language in a work such as the book of Ecclesiastes is. Verse 25, a new paragraph. I went on to reflect. I set my mind to inquire and search for wisdom and for the reason in things. But Solomon tried to understand the very nature of the whole of creation and human experience, the reason why all this exists, what we call the universe and the world. Only to discover, after he looked at human experience, that it's a folly to be wicked and madness to act like a fool. He actually experimented in these very areas. And he's telling about some of his own experiences. The wiles of a woman I find more bitter than death. And he's talking about certain kinds of women. Her heart is a trap to catch you, her arms are fetters. The man who is pleasing to God may escape. She will catch a sinner. So that defines the kind of woman she is. She's looking for that kind of man. She's not the woman looking for the right kind of man. Now, unfortunately, Solomon tended to look for this kind of woman in his own experience. So he said, see, says the speaker, that is the one who's giving the message, this is what I have found. Reasoning things out one by one, after searching long without success, I found one man in a thousand worth of name. That's a good expression. I have not found one woman among them all. That's the kind of women you attract them for yourself. He later tells you about the proper relationship to a woman who is a responsible wife. How could a man with a thousand women, 700 wives, 300 concubines, ever really have a woman he could love? Or how could a woman who would love a man love a Solomon who was like that, who shared his life with so many others? But in this world of individuals who go their own way, this is the illustration how rare it is to find anyone worth his name. This alone I have found, that man when he was, sorry, let me read this. This is a very very good verse, and I like this translation in the New English Bible especially, this last verse of chapter 7, verse 29. This alone I have found, that God, when he made man, made him straightforward. But man invents endless subtleties of his own. Now, you could say man was made upright. Well, he didn't walk on all four, that's obvious. Upright has a certain meaning and it tends to reflect the concept of character development that was really beyond Adam's. And I like, therefore, the English rendering here, straightforward. That is, he talked to God openly, straightforwardly, with nothing coming between them. A man who was straightforward in this sense didn't have any guile at the beginning. And I think this generally reflects what we mean when we say that man, as he was made at the beginning, the nature, let's say, of the spirit in man is neutral. But that term doesn't express itself as effectively here in our thinking as this expression in the New English Bible, that God, when he made man, made him straightforward in the way he deals with others. You could read it like an open book, so to speak. You sense the general approach that Adam had before sin changed the nature of his thinking, of his character, and things began to go wrong in his life because he let something else enter his mind than the spirit and thoughts of the Almighty. That is a very nice translation there at the end of that chapter. Let me just glance at another here. Yes, I like that the best. And then to invent endless subtleties of his own, I think that's as effective as any translation. Seeking out many devices might pertain to automobiles. But I like this expression. I think it really conveys the thought. Sometimes renderings will pertain to inventions, but this is very good. Subtleties of mind, the worst kind of thing, went out of control. And Jesus said it's easier for a prostitute to enter the kingdom of God than for subtle-minded theologians. Mm-hmm. Chapter 8, verse 1. Who is wise enough for all this? Who knows the meaning of anything? Solomon often seems to have expressed a kind of futile mood when he was writing and summing up what he had given his mind to. See, he was a man who sought to find the answer to why God said what he did by often doing what God told him not to do. He would have been far calmer, far happier, far more positive if he had just simply done what we in the church have been asked to do. That is, you start to do what God tells you, and then the wisdom will come. God gave Solomon the wisdom, and then he started to put it to use in experimentation and all sorts of subtleties to try to perceive it on his own. By, in many cases, doing the very opposite of what the law said. The law said you shall not commit adultery. He decided to have many wives, but certainly could hardly have avoided the spirit of adultery by any standards. And he ended up not finding one woman who was worth the name. Wisdom lights up a man's face, but grim looks make a man hate it. There are other renderings for that. You can check there. I'll just go through this one verse. I don't really perceive very much in the RSV there is helpful. I think the Jewish translation is just as good as any. A man's wisdom makes his face to shine, and the boldness of his face is changed. You know, when a man is bold in ignorance, he's an entirely different person than a man who has a certain boldness with wisdom to go with it, to know how to use it, he can take command. I think that is more likely the original. They pointed up in the footnote here that the Hebrew is obscure, which means the translation is doubtful. Do now here that we proceed to an area which I think is important to listen to, even though it deals with the king, talking about how to deal if you're an employee with a man in authority, perhaps how a wife ought to deal more often with her husband, how children should respect teachers, those responsible, their elders. Do as the king commands you, and if you have to swear by God, do not be precipitate. That is, don't do anything rashly. Think it through. Leave the king's presence. Listen carefully. Leave the king's presence. And do not persist in a thing which displeases him. There is a lesson in life. If there's something that you're arguing about and it's simply getting nowhere, Solomon says, this is undoubtedly expressing what he wished people would have done, leave the king's presence and do not persist in a thing which displeases the king. He, after all, does what he chooses. Whoever obeys the command will come to no harm. Says that in the first place, it's advisable to do what the king said and don't persist in some other argument. A wise man knows in his heart the right time and method for action. There is a time and a method for every enterprise. We learn, therefore, that if you want to persuade anyone, there is a time and a way to do it. Have you ever realized that very often somebody can come up with the very thing you needed to know, but he presented it in the very way that turned you off? I've had it happen. Mr. Armstrong has had it happen. There probably are many who've had it happen, though we may not all have perceived it. But I have found this to be true. We need to be very careful how we present things. There is a time, and therefore there's also not a time. And there is one method that may be right, and there's another method that may be wrong for every enterprise. And looking in life in general, although man is greatly troubled by ignorance of the future, that is, there are ways of making things work out, even though we may not know or perceive just how it will turn out. Who can tell him what it will bring? It's just not in man's power to restrain the wind. No one has power over the day of death. Turn it aside. So what Solomon is pointing up here is that even if we try certain things, they may or may not work out. We don't actually have full control in the various areas of life in which we operate. If we had full control, we would, of course, be in the place of the Almighty. But any decision, any economic, any marital decision, or any employment decision, these are all subject to so many forces than just you and someone else. And Solomon is warning about this. That means the wise man will think through as deeply as he can and anticipate all sorts of possibilities. In war, no one can lay aside his arms. And of course, no wealth will save its possessor. Now, in a sense, that's a generalization. I know that there are cases where wealth did save the possessor. Greece's richest Jew escaped because he had enough money. The Germans decided that it was worth keeping him around to make more. I met met him. He was the leading furniture manufacturer in Greece. We met him in Athens in 1971. A delightful person, with real charm. If he hadn't had any money, he would have been dead. But generally speaking, this is true. And Solomon, of course, will point out exceptions to his generalizations. And of course, in the long run, this is true of everybody. All this I have seen, having applied my mind to everything that's done under the sun, that is, in this world. He was experimenting with things in this world. There was a time when one man had power over another to make him suffer. It was then that I saw wicked men approaching and even entering the holy place. And they went about the city priding themselves on having done right. Now, there are different renderings of this, different senses, but this certainly conveys a thought that is clear and useful. All this is emptiness, you know, bragging about being right in the name of righteousness, in the name of religion. And there's, of course, coming a time when truly wicked men are going to be operating in the name of religion. Wicked in the sense that they know what they're doing. I am quite sure that there are many men in the area of religion who may be deceived in some areas of doctrine, but whose character and moral and concern for other people is upright. We were headed for a time in the foreseeable future that is called the tribulation. And here you have a sample of that that can happen in anyone's lifetime. It is because sentence upon a wicked act is not promptly carried out that men do evil so boldly. That should be the motto of the whole judicial and prison system. And we would solve many, many problems now extent. It should, in fact, be essentially a motto in milder form, we're replacing the word wicked act in terms of childbearing. A sinner may do wrong and live to old age, yet I know that it will be well for those who fear God. Their fear of him ensures this. So Solomon perceived that there is one fundamental thing, that no matter if the righteous die early, no matter what they endure, their fear of God ensures them that it will all work out well in the end. But it will not be well with a wicked man, nor will he have any promise living long. I am sparing the rendering, because Solomon already said that he's seen the wicked in old age. But in general, that doesn't happen. The man who does not fear God is a mere shadow. You know, not even the reality casting the shadow is in the flesh. But even the shadow, that's just how transitory he is. So you see that if man himself is so, as a mortal human being, is so temporary, and then when you look at the wicked who do not fear God, they are even classed as a shadow that can disappear momentarily. There is an empty thing found on earth. When the just man gets what is due to the unjust, this is an awful statement. And the unjust, what is due to the just. And this happened certainly in the last war. I maintain that this too is emptiness. That is just vanity. You know, vanity is an unfortunate word because it tends to make you think, you know, of creeping up what you see in the mirror. The English translation here of emptiness is probably an indication that if it doesn't satisfy you as a word, there's nothing in English that really is truly satisfactory to convey it. But I think it's as good as anything in this sense, that there's nothing greater than total emptiness, whether of the mind or of the universe. And so Solomon sees that when things don't go right, when things seem to be turned upside down, that it is a terrible state of affairs. So I commend enjoyment. Since there is nothing good for a man to do here under the sun, in the physical things, I'm not talking about spiritual principles, there's nothing good for a man to do here under the sun but to eat, drink, and enjoy himself. There's no use being a perpetual Nazarite, not necessarily, unless you were asked to be. There's no use abstaining from every blessing that God has given. So this is all that will remain with him to reward his toil in the physical realm throughout the span of life which God grants him here under the sun. And that is, I'll summarize it again, that you eat and you drink and you enjoy yourself. Solomon's going to say, of course, later that you also learn to govern. But a man who does not eat with pleasure, who drinks with conscience, and is always condemning himself, is never happy. And that joy may be expressed in things spiritual as well as things physical. And Solomon is pointing up here that the kind of self-condemnation that is opposite to this, that the praise on a person's mind is not what leads to repentance, it's what leads to suicide. I applied my mind, verse 16, to acquire wisdom and to observe the business which goes on upon earth. When man never closes an eye in sleep day or night, you know, struggling to make ends meet, and always I perceive that God has so ordered it that man should not be able to discover what's happening here under the sun. You know that in the realm of the stock market and in the economy, that economists do not all agree. There isn't any area that I know of where it is possible to have agreement, even when you have access to physical evidence that may be examined scrupulously and scientifically, because there are things that can't be measured that way. The impact of God, the impact of the realm of angels, whether good or evil, the government of the devil, the influence of human mind, the impact of generations of society, all affect the world and cannot be measured scientifically. So in this sense, man can never fully perceive what's happened here. However hard a man may try, he just will not find out. This is why, let's say, a study of the world's economy will always, in part, remain an art. It will never be a full and true discipline and exact science. I'm using that, but you could use any other area you wish. But this is very important today, with the dollar bouncing up and down, more up and down than up. The wise man may think that he knows, and there are economists who will prophesy what will happen next year. There are people who can predict or think what will happen next year. But in reality, he'll be unable to find the truth. He may even have the answer, but he'll have it for the wrong reason. Or he may have the very causes pinpointed and the results will be different. That's just the way it is in life. Chapter 9. I applied my mind to all this, and I understood that the righteous and the wise and all their doings are under God's control. That is, in the end, God allows or disallows, so that God is ultimately responsible. It's all ultimately under his control.
reason that Satan is here now is that God allows it.
Very important thing to realize. Everything that confronts him, that is man, everything is empty, since one and the same fate befalls everyone. Just and unjust alike, good and bad, clean and unclean, the man who offers sacrifice and the man who doesn't. And this is exactly different from what Solomon said before. Because here he says everything, listen carefully, the same fate befalls everyone. And in this case, it's not altogether true. He has pointed out earlier that there are exceptions. He has named the exceptions. When the wicked seek to inherit the blessings of the righteous, and the righteous the punishments that ought to go to the wicked. Yet, if you consider the ultimate, we all go through the ups and downs, and without any question, the bulk of humanity goes through the same experience. Just and unjust alike, good and bad. You know what Jesus said in principle is right that God causes the rain to fall on all sorts of people, the good and the bad. That's just the way nature is. Good man and sinner fare alike. The man who can take an oath, the man who dares not. But we also found the good man and sinner don't fare alike. So you learn some of these interesting things in the way Solomon wrote it. That sometimes we all suffer the same thing, and sometimes we suffer different things. Seem unjust, and that's a terrible vanity or emptiness. This is what is wrong in all that is done here under the sun. The one and the same fate befalls every man. And Solomon there is certainly right. You know, we all die, the just and the unjust. Point another man wants to die. And so many things happen to everybody. The suffering, life, too often there really is no distinction in penalty no matter what one does or what one doesn't like. And Solomon perceived that as one of the things in this world. Now, this would indicate in part that much of the world, you see, that is under God's control also is an expression not just of God's government, but of opposition, that is, rebellion to God's government, because these things ought not happen this way. There should be a penalty to the wicked and blessings to the righteous. And that's why Solomon said, when he was contemplating what all this was, he said something in the end of verse 1 that I did not read to you, because I felt we should go down here before we go back. Now, Solomon said at the end of verse 1, or just before the end, that the righteous and the wise and all their doings are under God's control. But is it, that is what we experience, but is it love or hatred? No man really knows. Now let me explain that remarkable perception. That all the things that happen that are under God's control can reflect love or hatred. It can reflect love if it is God who is acting. God who is blessing. It can also reflect hatred if what is occurring under his control is what the devil is allowed to do. And yet, when it's all said and done, do we really know the ultimate purpose? Sometimes what God allows the devil to do when he hates the righteous may be for our own good and ultimately express the love of God despite the devil's hate, bringing us to see and understand something through suffering that we would have learned no other way.
You think it's true. Compare translations. I think this is a very effective way of rendering the depth of perception Solomon had. The hearts of men are full of evil. That's a generalization. Hopefully yours is being cleaned up. Madness fills their hearts all through their lives. Solomon was dealing with an unconverted world, as you know, as a whole. And after that, they go down to join the dead. So he really wasn't too distressed by the fact that since men are this evil, that's probably where they belong anyway. But for a man who is counted among the living, at least there is hope. That, you know, there's some things he can do and change. Remember, he says, a live dog is better than a dead lion. True, the living know, that should be clear to all of you. In other words, no matter what, how ordinary, how without honor you may be, to be alive is better than a dead king. Like a lion, like a king of beasts. True, the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. Now, of course, that is for us an important theological statement, but in its context here, beside its theology, it's also a clear reality that when life is over, the dead simply know nothing of what is going on any further in human experience. But the living know that that's what their fate is, and then after that, there's just nothing that a man knows. He's unconscious. In the ultimate sense of the word, the sleep of death. There are no more rewards for them. They're utterly forgotten. Now, not everybody is utterly forgotten. Solomon isn't. Caesar isn't. Napoleon isn't. Apparently, Adam and Eve are not. But in general, we can say this. Because most people have been forgotten. Out of all the billions in the world, you probably would be hard-pressed to name 1,000 people. Considering all who died. For them, love and hate, ambition, all are now over. Never again in this society, I add, will they have any part in what is done here under the sun. Now Solomon knows there's coming a resurrection on the basis of the 12th chapter, but in this age, in the sun, in this world, as we now know it, that's what Solomon is using here, their part is over. Once life has been lived and death has occurred, it's so absolute, it's like an iron door through which you can never penetrate except by resurrection in another age. Go to it then, eat your food and enjoy it, and drink your wine with a cheerful heart. Don't let all this oppress you. That's what he's saying. You can reflect on all this and feel miserable. And Solomon did. But he learned that that was not good either. He learned that was vanity. He learned it was much better to at least enjoy the physical things in life that we have. For already God has accepted what you have done. That is, if you're cheerful, when you have this attitude toward life, and when you enjoy these things, God accepts this appreciation. Now, I happen to be dressed in a black suit. Solomon says here, always be dressed in white. Now, what he means, brethren, is keep your clothes clean. Because the garments in the Middle East were generally white. But there are people who wear black. But in that day, the general garment was white. Today, often, the black. Black for women, white for men. The meaning is, don't let it become gray. Oh, in other words, if you're going to enjoy food, if you're going to enjoy drink, if you're going to enjoy life, you also might as well enjoy being clean. And never fail to anoint your head. That is, you know, keep cheerful. Don't let your hair be messy and straggly. You know, how you look at yourself is a little bit about the kind of respect you have toward yourself. And let me summarize it this way. The fellow, I'm speaking to men, the fellow who is sloppy about his desk, and unkempt, and couldn't care how his hair is, has such little respect for himself that in general this image is a part of the society which also is morally corrupt, who have so little self-respect they couldn't care whether they're with prostitutes or not, or with other women, or now with other men. Self-respect in these areas will often lead you to have a whole new outlook on morals. Now there's the man, of course, who always presents himself to cover up what is sin. But I'm talking about a person who from within is cheerful and enjoys being what God has made him. I remember we were having some discussion, maybe it was this very thing, who knows, years ago about it. Mr. Ronald Keller, the minister, said in class one day, you know, we were pointing up that anybody who wants to be somebody else is a real problem to himself. And I asked, we were just discussing it, you know, and I said, probably, I'll just put it this way, whether I said it or not, you know, I would not want to be Mr. Keller said, and I wouldn't want to be you. And I agreed with it, and this was right. Anybody who wants to be somebody else, who has such a low respect for himself, who cannot appreciate what God has made, or who is unable to live with his handicaps, is headed down the road of many who are suicides in fact. So enjoy life with a woman you love all the days of your allotted span here under the sun. I'm sure this is awfully British today. You're going to have a better rendering there, because that could imply any woman. It doesn't imply what I want to convey from it. Let me get the thought here in chapter 9, verse 9. It's going to take in RSV. Enjoy life with a wife whom you love. That's what we love. Not your woman. But read it carefully then, and I will depart from the translation when it urges. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your same life that God has given you under the sun. That's true of humanity. You look back, you may be happy you're married, as we had a couple here during the Feast of Tabernacles, they're married 60 years. In those years, seem to have gone by so fast, one could almost say, you know, it's empty. You wonder, you know, how quickly it went. And yet, life really should be full. And we have to realize it's all very short. Empty as these years are, that's what Solomon points out. You really wonder, you know, how so many years could go by so fast when you've done so little. So that is your lot while you live and labor here under the sun. So it's very important to take a look at life, to appreciate the one you live with, and woman should express the same thing for her husband, and to enjoy. A woman who hates cooking, who hates her husband, is miserable within. A man who hates the things he has to do, a man who hates the woman he lives with, is terrible and miserable within. Because hate eats these things, eats the inner person away like a cancer. Whatever task lies to your hand, do it with all your might. Because in Sheol, translated off in the grave, for which you are bound, there is nothing doing nor thinking. There is neither doing nor thinking. Neither understanding nor wisdom. Death is so absent. speed doesn't win the race, your strength the battle. Now, sometimes it may. But this is the general truth. And you sometimes have to compare the contrasts. There were cases in the last, let's say, the 1967 and 1973 wars in the Middle East, without any question, speed did win the race. But you have to understand that that's because God allowed it to. But it may be a factor. But in a sense, what Solomon is saying here is that these things alone do not. There is something more, and it may use these things, but alone by themselves is not the case. Bread doesn't belong to the wise, nor wealth to the intelligent. But I will tell you that more people who are intelligent have wealth than those who are ignorant. And, of course, the man who is generally ignorant will have more bread. But it isn't always so. Nor success to the skillful. Because, after all, it's said and done, time and chance govern all. Time and chance govern all. That is, some of you just simply fell into a situation. But it does not hurt to be wise. It doesn't hurt to be intelligent. You can add to your wealth. You can have more bread. But those alone, that's what Solomon is telling us, are insufficient for time and chance to govern many things. Perhaps you have made every right decision, and now you've come to the place you must take action, and you discover that the interest rate has gone up, you can't borrow any money, the project you had in mind has to fall through because you can't come up with a down payment. You know, we waited a long time to sell a British campus for reasons such as that. Many problems. Time and chance just wasn't right for people who wished they could have had it. They were forced to withdraw. But that's not finished. No man knows when his hour will come. Like fish caught in a net, like a bird taken in a snare. So men are trapped when bad times come suddenly. Now they can happen. Bad times are not always depressions. They can be inflation periods. But we don't always know when these things happen. Sometimes we can predict. It is just as likely that it's unpredictable. Herbert Hoover did not foresee in 1931 what was coming in 1932 because the economy was swinging up after the debacle of 29. In our society, I don't think the United States, the President of the United States, was not even prepared in the days of President Nixon for the crisis in 1970-71 to hit the economy, and then the inflation later. Even leaders of a country are not fully aware. I don't think the President of the United States today is aware of the impact of inflation deflating the dollar. And he waited a very long time before acting. But that's just the way life is. You never know when everything suddenly catapults down the economic slope. This proves an example of wisdom as I have observed in your paragraph. As I have observed it here under the sun, and notably, I find it. There was a small town with few inhabitants, and a great king came to attack it. He besieged it and constructed great siege works against it. There was in it a poor wise man, and he alone might have saved the town by his wisdom. But no one remembers that poor wise man. Surely, I said to myself, wisdom is better than strength. And that is true. Solomon recognized that all the monies can't save you, and wisdom is what you need. And he's bringing this up after what he said before to show how often, even with wisdom, you're forgotten. Even though you might have solved life's problems with it in your lifetime. A wise man who speaks his mind calmly is more to be heeded than a commander shouting orders among the fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Of course, this is not true in the Arab world. Billions of dollars are being spent to acquire weapons of war rather than the wisdom to deal with Israel. And this terrible situation in the Middle East that is only at the beginning of a series of crises is going to lead to the undoing of everything. The undoing of human life if God would not intervene. So we read now, wisdom is better than weapons of war. One mistake can undo so many things done well. Remember that. This work has gone through experiences like that, maybe your homeland. Just a few basic mistakes can undo many things for years that were done well. That's the nature of the vanity, the emptiness of this world, that so many things are necessary to do well, and so few things can spoil everything. Chapter 10 is not a long one. We'll take a brief look. The dead fly pointless turn rancid. For me. That's a beautiful expression there. So can a little folly make wisdom lose its worth. That is, you must be very careful, just the least amount of foolishness, mistake, can ruin all the work of your wisdom. The mind of the wise man faces right. Mind of a fool faces left. Now, this is not a political statement. It is a principle. You see, the thought in the Middle East, and of course, this is true in the Arab world, that to do anything correctly, you know, you do it with your right hand, not with your left. And so the thought is that when you face in the one direction, that's the direction that you look when you're wise, and you turn around the other, that's when you look and you're making mistakes, you're lacking wisdom. But there may be some political overtones. Certainly the sense of terrorism of the left is most unfortunate today. But the tragic terrorism of World War II from the right is even worse. Such a short period. Even when he walks along the road, now you should think a fool who's on the road won't have any trouble, he shows no sense and calls everyone else a fool. Now, the meaning of that, let's look in verse 3 somewhere else because I think it's better. Even when the fool walks on the road, he lacks sense. And he says to everyone that he's a fool by the way he conducts himself. That's the meaning. I think the good rendering of the RSV there. If your ruler breaks out in anger against you, if your ruler breaks out in anger against you, don't resign your post. The submission makes amends for great mistakes on your part. Submission makes amends for great mistakes. Everyone needs to learn this, whether in the family, children to parents, husbands to wives to husbands, I mean the whole thing, it doesn't matter. It's very important to learn this principle. Don't just quit your post. Submission makes amends for great mistakes. In the sense that you now acknowledge the other's authority, you acknowledge your mistake. So there's a reason why someone was angry. So be submissive. Take the rap. Acknowledge your part. Don't justify yourself. That's not submission. There is an evil that I have observed here under the sun, an error for which a ruler is responsible. The fool given high office, but the great and the rich in humble posts. In other words, when leaders put in office, this can happen in any kind of society in this world, individuals who do not handle themselves wisely. This is a very grave error of a ruler to put a fool in a high office and neglect individuals who are, let's say, great and rich in this sense of Solomon means, you know, a rich man is a man who uses his funds to assist in his role, take an ambassador to another country. You can't have a man who is poor because an ambassador must use some of his own money because he's never paid enough to be gracious to others. I have a gift at this very time to send to an ambassador, the Thai ambassador to Iran, in whose home I have been a guest. In a sense, not officially representing the Ambassador Foundation, but I do have friends in the Thai community here. And this man and his wife are charming people who put themselves out. Men, a man of greatness, and his wife a woman of charm, and certainly no mean income on their own, because they have to be very generous and concerned with others. He has just recently gone to Iran, a very critical area of the world. I have seen slaves on horseback and men of high rank going on foot like slaves. The man who digs a pit may fall into it. He who pulls down a wall may be bitten by the snake that's in it on the other side. You know, these Middle Eastern walls are very likely where scorpions and snakes can crawl in crevices and eight walls. Having been in Syria in the first 2 weeks of October, we know that. And of course, it can be found.
Man, it goes to the stomach and is eliminated, and whatever nourishment you get is suitable for you, because what the body is, what is not washed off initially, will simply be eliminated and will not cause you any harm of that nature or any harm of consequence. So, happily here, the revised, authorized version is even an improvement on the King James. I like the word foods because he's not just addressing meat, flesh. Foods is very good for modern English. So this is a good translation despite everybody's problem with Romans 14:14. Then we'll look at a few others along the way. Let's take another one here. Proverbs 22:6. Now, this may have been addressed to you, but I would like to address it again, as I heard this given by one of our ministers giving a special sermon at the Imperial AM. In Proverbs 22:6, all the modern English versions that are group versions seem not to have comprehended it. The present authorized version, the revised authorized version didn't, and the revised standard didn't seem to get it. Let me read it to you and just briefly mention that the Jewish translation has it correct. Apparently, early editions of the King James seems to have had it correct, And some translators, like Moffat, grasp it correctly. Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. This is to give you, in that rendering, the impression that if you train up a child the way that he should go, that you focus on when he is old, that some way he'll come back to it. That's the way it's been understood. But the original Hebrew is correctly rendered in the Jewish 1917 version, where it says, or nearly so, to train up a child in the way that he should go, and even when he's old, he will not depart from it. He should have been doing it all along, is the implication. It's not an excuse. It's not an excuse to say that if you really train up a child the way that he shall go, he will regularly depart from it until he gets old. That's not the intent. Now, David trained some sons inadequately, and they revolted, rebelled, and tragedies befell them. He trained one other son as a child, but he died before that child was mature. That child was still tender, and the training was not altogether finished. David said that when Solomon succeeded him, he was still a tender child. If Josephus, who misunderstands a part of it, is not incorrect, Josephus thought that Solomon had to be old because he was wise. So he gave him 40 more years. Said he died at 84. 94, was it? 94, something like that. Anyway, the implication by looking at what Josephus has done is that Solomon reigned 40 years and was really only 14 when he came to the throne. He was still young and tender. He was in his earlier teens. He was clearly not yet 20. That's quite clear from the law. But he had been well trained up to this point. But he was not yet fully trained, and finally, unfortunately, he drifted in another direction when he was old. But this verse should be seen. I'd like you to read a Moffat translation or some other one and see, but certainly the Jewish has it correctly. For some reason, it just was not comprehended. Now we'll look at another one. Of course, we could go on with many, but let's try one in the Old Testament now. In the book of Genesis, I would like you to see at least one place where this version has indeed clarified a point that was lost in the authorized version, which without it, it was unfortunate. In Genesis chapter 11, it isn't a question of the original, it's a question of how you translate it. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech, the authorized version. And the whole earth was of one language and one speech. Now, very correctly, you will note in chapter 10:1, now these are the generations. Chapter 12:1, now the Lord said to Abraham. The authorized version, for some reason, left the word "and" at the beginning of chapter 11, when in fact it would have been correct to do what the Jews have done and what the revised authorized version correctly has done. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. I'm addressing that because we had assumed for a long time, and I did, based on the King James Version, that before the flood, there was only one language among human beings. We assume that Genesis 11:1 was an indication that languages only arose after the flood. What we have here is, after the world as a whole was obliterated by water, there was one family and there was one speech. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech, in contrast to what it had been. And then we shall discover that languages in this side, this world that we know since the flood, have arisen, as at the Tower of Babel. But just so you understand it better, Deuteronomy 32:8 makes it quite clear that there was a time when God divided the world to the different sons of Adam, as he also divided the world to the different sons of Noah. And in the days of Noah, Nimrod didn't like the fact that God divided the world up, and he wanted to make it one to prevent it. But when God divided the sons of Noah, he had not yet given these various languages. That happened at Babel. But if you note carefully, in Deuteronomy 32, verse 8, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, not Ish, but Adam. If this was a reference exclusively to after the flood, it would have said when he separated the sons of Noah, to show that it was only an event after the flood. That's not true. This was a time when God separated the sons of Adam, and archaeologically you can find there are different racial groups around the world, in the world before the flood just as much as afterward, and the way you keep people separate is you give them different languages or they will not stay separate. Now, I'm only stating what clearly here is rendered. You would not know the rest of the story until you opened the books. But we misunderstood history for years, because when we found that there were different languages at certain periods of time, we assumed that those periods of time were all after the flood, and they weren't. In any case, there has been a correction in Genesis 11:1. But unfortunately, the same word was not corrected in giving real meaning to Genesis 1, verse 2. In Genesis 1, verse 2, the King James has, "And the earth was without form and void." The Revised Authorized Version merely says, "The earth was without form and void." It has dropped the word that is translated "and." You see, sometimes it can be better rendered as "and," and sometimes "now," or some expression of that nature. Properly speaking, the Jewish translation is the only one, leaving it as simple as possible, which has seen the issue. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In the beginning. Now the earth was without form and void, another period in time. Unfortunately, the Authorized Version had an "and," which didn't clarify it. The Jewish correctly clarified it in their 1917 translation. The new one is nonsense. It goes back to the ideas. When God began to create the world, it was in chaos and confusion, but that's their God. He thinks that way. And most modern translators want to read that into it. But none of the early translators, whether Ethiopic, whether Slavonic, whether Latin, whether Arabic, whether Aramaic, Coptic, or whatever, they all understood it as "in the beginning." God created the heavens and the earth. That means that the Jews all originally understood that verse 1:1 of Genesis correctly. And when advising translators, as many of them did, they all perceived it in that light. "Now the earth was without form and void" is talking about a later event. Some of these are very small matters, but they underlie very basic doctrine. If you do not understand the doctrine, you cannot render the translation as adequate as it should be. Now, we have to work with translations of people who do not understand the doctrine. It is not our purpose to say we ought to have a perfect translation, but it is our purpose to say that with the skills that are rather simple, knowing the basic doctrine of the Bible already made known to you by the church, you can go through the differences and spot where these problems are and make corrections that are not based arbitrarily on human speculation, but based on the fact that the Scripture requires it. The words are there, they simply haven't been rendered correctly. Let me just say one thing. Happily, this translation has substituted Hades, if that could be happy. There's no good English word, so you might as well leave the Greek and then define it in the footnote. To call it the world of the dead or the underworld, that won't do either. And to call it simply a grave won't do either, because Hades was more than a single grave or tomb. But at least it is not rendered as hell. Acts 2, 27 to 31. You will not leave his soul in Hades. Acts 2, 27 and 31. There at least we have pointed up that hell, in the new translations, and most of them, the RSV, the RAV, all go to the proper Greek and don't link it up. They do use hell fire or the fire of hell in this, because that's very common, and we've never objected to hell, although we always define it in terms of Gehenna, when Gehenna or the Valley of Hinnom is the word. I would mention one other thing now in closing, and that is that in 1 John 5, 7 to 8, this translation was super cautious and left the reference to the Trinity, as Mr. Parton would have addressed to you last night if you were there, left the reference to the Trinity in the text, but put it in the footnote that it really was not there except in the original Greek, but was only in late Greek manuscripts. Now, there's much more that could be added, but I've tried to address certain specific subjects that pertain to doctrine and not small technicalities. Doctrine that are doctrines big enough that enable you to understand that simple words can escape the translator simply because they didn't grasp what the intent of Scripture is in these cases. Just as almost all translations in Revelation 20 speak of where the beast and the false prophet, and then there is nothing in the Greek, but they're always adding that present tense of the verb to be, plural, are, instead of were cast. That is doctrine again. That's not grammar. It's understanding doctrine. Because when two mortal human beings are cast in the lake of fire, they're not going to be alive in there for 1,000 years. That is simply where they were cast. And in that lake, which is then after the millennium, the area where God throws, shall we say, or casts Satan, he and his demons all are removed from the earth. And hence the plural in the Greek verb that follows. They have misunderstood the they to refer to the devil, the beast, and the false prophet, instead of the devil and his demons. Because the beast and the false prophet were mortal men. But the devil and his demons are all at that point removed. And then, of course, comes the resurrection. So if you will please take some time when you have the chance, when you have a new version, and look at some of the critical areas. In a sense, it should give you confidence that you're able to spot the problem, confidence in what the church has taught, that you can indeed sometimes find a translation that has it correct, and furthermore, it should give you confidence when the translation is correct, to know that you can read without doubt over most of the Bible, and once in a while you'll want to check, because some little things like and or now or in or of, or unclean or common, can cause people to stumble, or words that are missing, like are, that should have been something else, were cast. So if you have never had a translation like this or the New International Version, it certainly would pay you, as we've said in Bible studies before, to get another copy to compare with the one you normally use as a precaution.